It's Fascism Friday, everybody.
Everybody's favorite day.
Yeah, this is December 4th, 2020, and this is episode 131 of Transmission.
Yeah, and I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
I'm Mark Van Stenwick. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
Yeah, and so yesterday, as part of our conversation, a lot of stuff is coming up about bodies and embodiment. Mm-hmm. We're talking about spirituality and narcissism and some of the issues related to that. And so there were a number of people who were like, yeah, we need to do another body related episode. And we thought, mm-hmm. let's weave it into Fascism Friday.
Yes.
Because there is this very interesting phenomenon in fascist slash authoritarian slash extremely imperial cultures, where there is this very interesting both worship of, quote, perfect embodiment, mm-hmm. and also the oppression of what is perceived to be not perfect embodiment. Mm-hmm. Thought we could put these two things together.
Yeah. And it's interesting, like, so using the Nazis as the typical, I guess, example of fascism that people think of, a lot of people don't realize that there was this strong ecological component to Nazism. Like, they wanted to, like, expand the land of the German people, and they didn't want it to be some sort of industrial wasteland. They wanted to restore, like, they had this idea that they needed to embrace the fullness of nature with themselves as basically the apex predator, the most evolved, the Übermensch. And so it's not like they were anti-creation or body, but that way of thinking with fascism at some level is a worship of hierarchy. And so there is this sort of like greater flesh, lesser flesh. And that results in them even like internalizing like a really destructive view of their own bodies. So like they had this really hyper masculinist, take care of your body as a temple that almost seems kind of like, to me, it almost seems kind of Mormon, like don't drink coffee, don't smoke kind of thing. Treat your body well. But it wasn't a move towards deeper sensuality and organic relationships. It was like mastery of one's body, just as the German people must gain mastery over the earth. That's a toxic way to look at yourself.
Yeah, and I was thinking that, we love to rip on the Nazis for good reason.
the villain of every Indiana Jones film. Right.
I thought it would be great to bring this a little closer to home, and I want to share the story of the history of the seminary that I went to, San Francisco Theological Seminary, which is tied into all of this in a really interesting way. So San Francisco Theological Seminary is not in San Francisco. It's in Marin County, which is, for those of you who are not familiar with Bay Area geography, is the area just north of San Francisco across the Golden Gate Bridge. And Marin County is, there's a lot of open space there. There's a lot of parks. Mountain biking was invented in Marin County. It's also incredibly wealthy. Very, very expensive place to live. So San Francisco Seminary started in San Francisco in the late 19th century. I believe it was 1882, somewhere around there. But very soon afterwards, about a decade, I think it was in San Francisco for 12 years, they decided to move to Marin. Now, at the time, Marin was basically a vacation destination for wealthy people in the Bay Area. Of course, none of the bridges existed, and You can only get there by boat because the Delta comes down from the north. There was no bridge over that. You obviously couldn't walk across the bay. And so people would go there by boat, and they would go there for the weekend. They would go there for, you know, outdoor recreation. And there was this whole movement in Protestant Christianity called masculine Christianity. Mm-hmm. And it was this idea that if you were going to be close to God, you had to be pumped up, and you had to have this great body, and you had to be athletic, and you had to be physically fit. And so Marin County was viewed as being like the ideal place to do this and to raise these, you know, fit, pumped up pastors. And even though it was a graduate school, they were able to apply to compete in NCAA sports. And they had sports teams, and they actually did that until I think their last team went until the early 1950s. I think they were involved in rowing until the early 1950s. This is very much a part of our heritage as well, right? This notion that, you know, if you get closer to God, and we mentioned this yesterday in terms of, the sex appeal of mainline of mega pastors, that they have to have this sex appeal. There really is this idea, right, that good bodies, however society defines that, are closer to God. And, bad bodies are not. And it's incredibly unhealthy.
Yeah, and think about today. Like, so it's fascinating watching this sort of white middle class, upper middle class, wealthy turn towards like yoga and different things. And there's some corrective, like we realize there's something out of whack and we lean towards that. But just the way it ends up being done is often kind of like, this is where all the jokes come from. It's often wrapped in a sort of shaming rubric. So like, I'm still overweight, but I've lost over 100 pounds. And it's fascinating how people treat me differently and what they would say before. Like, there was often an assumption that there was something fundamentally lacking about me and my character, right? And so that the idea of working out is like this sort of shame motivation in order to become fit as a way of gaining mastery. It's about mastery over yourself and showing that you are worthy, rather than looking at the relationship you have with your body, how you feel about your body, how you relate to the other living things. And it's just interesting. Like, to me, it's kind of caught up in this metaphor. Like, I heard this on NPR. Someone was talking about how we mistranslate carpe diem, which is fascinating. It translates as pluck the day, the way you'd pluck a turnip out of the ground. But for some reason, we feel like the need to seize the day. And that kind of captures the Western trajectory. Like, even the way we think about it, it's like the kind of the hospitable and gentle nature of pulling. Well, sometimes root vegetables can be a struggle, but plucking something versus seizing it shows that relationship we have. It kind of typifies the relationship we have with bodies and the land and created things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Got some comments already coming in.
Coming in. That's awesome.
And Lori and Ron seem like they're new listeners today, so welcome. Welcome to everyone else who's listening and watching, I guess. Ceres writes, I heard a lot of rich caucasity stories about Marin County.
Yes, there are many.
I can only guess. Is that basically the equivalent? Would like Minnetonka be kind of
like, yeah,
roughly, yeah, our equivalent? Yep. Okay.
Yeah, definitely. Right. So, Lake Minnetonka is the Marin of Minneapolis and the Twin Cities.
The recreational playground of the affluent. Gotcha.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So the Mark Driscoll shit happened in San Francisco Theological Seminary too in the 1920s. What is it with the West Coast coming up with this baloney?
Except muscular. Did I say masculine Christianity?
You did.
Because muscular Christianity did not originate in the West Coast. And of course, it was masculine because all the pastors were men, but muscular Christianity.
The Freudian slip is apt, though.
Yeah, it's apt.
the idea of muscularity, like, you know, these big movements was really tied up in a masculine understanding of yourself, even though women did participate in sort of the fitness shifts that happened.
This did not originate on the West Coast. I mean, this was a real movement that also, and again, this is where the fascism tie-in comes in, right? So the same people that were promoting this in the early 20th century were then also the people that gathered to create fundamentalism, right? And so right after 1910, when they got together to start to talk about what are the fundamentals of the faith against which thou shalt not pass, right? Thou shalt not question. You know, it was all the same folks. And these were all tall steeple pastors, very famous in their day, very well known. And this toxic body relationship, this toxic theology, you know, anti-science, anti-reflection on things like evolution, all of that is lumped together. And, you know, it's not a coincidence that all of that becomes bound up with authoritarian political and economic systems.
What decades were... Do you think that was most active?
Well, it was the 1890s, 1910s. Yeah,
it's fascinating because like this connection just plopped into my mind because in that time period there was a strong assumption that black and white were different races and that black people were fundamentally incapable, right, of ascending. Mm-hmm. But then the progressive movement. So when we use the word progressive, like we have to understand that the first progressive movement politically is usually linked with Teddy Roosevelt. And progressives then were people who said, look, black people are clearly inferior, but if you give them the right tools, they too can ascend. And out of that milieu was really kind of that same ethos was where eugenics started really gaining ascendancy. And that was considered progressive. Because the idea was, look, if people... A lot of people shouldn't have to be born into that. So if we could select the best of our traits and allow other people groups to do that, then we could all progress together. And so this idea of eugenics, of culling the weak from the herd, really tied up with this evolutionary way of thinking, was really strong in the United States as a progressive movement. And you can see that factoring in to this fascistic understanding of what healthy bodies were. You see, their whole thing was trying to cull humanity of its weak elements. That was their whole rationale. And in their mind, it wasn't even out of hatred in their thinking. It was about a love of the purity of the people and making the world a utopian garden. So it's interesting, like if we take a step back from that and look at like, you can see those kinds of ways of thinking in the mix now, and it's not polite to call it Nazism, but it's still some of that same sort of thing. Like I'll still hear people say, like, this is really uncomfortable to say, but part of the logic, you know, abortion was tied in with eugenics thinking. Conservatives bring this up all the time, but I still hear kind of a eugenic language from some liberal people saying, see, it was better for that baby not to be born into poverty. And see, once you say that, I feel like you've crossed a line into away from women's right to choose to a logic of eugenics. It's not just a fascistic thing. It's part of this whole mix of domination that we've inherited. Just crossed a political hotspot with that statement. If anybody wants to chime in.
Go, go, go. All right. I've got more to say. Let's go back to the comments.
Okay. Gus says, this description of Nazis to ecology sounds a lot like some of the relationship between much of the whole earth catalog and co-evolution style back in the 70s, back to the land movement, at least from what I've read before my time.
I mean, having lived through that, I yes and no. I mean, what I would say is that the relationship would be that that a lot of the way that environmentalism movement has played out in our country is very much white driven and privilege driven. And it is very much about, we want some of the land kept nice so that we can enjoy it. It certainly was not connected to a wider political ideology in that sense. But yeah, it's totally connected to privilege and to, you know, some people wanting to be able to enjoy the land in certain ways. And of course, now, you know, you can see the you can see how that's really a failed approach, because, you know, if you go to national parks, I mean, as the park system has evolved, as climate change has progressed, as ecological devastation has progressed, I mean, I've really noticed that national parks and places like that feel more and more like zoos for trees, right? Like they feel tired [S2] Yes. [S1] And kind of sickly. They don't feel in any way like wilderness, right? They just feel like, okay, here are these spaces that we're sort of trying to keep out the devastation that is everywhere because of our failed relationship with the rest of the planet. And sometimes I find going to these places really depressing, actually, because energetically I can just feel like, yeah, no, this is not working.
It's still the domination narrative, because it's not, yeah. There are people who say we need to have these places as preserves basically for their own sake. But the way funding works and everything is to like build the case that we can enjoy it. And so like, that's why the Alaskan wilderness is always up for grabs, because people don't wander around it as much. Like, but if you say, let's do that to Yellowstone, let's tap it for oil. People are like, no, it's a political outcry because it exists for us. It's part of our domination. We want to be able to enjoy it. No. It's strange because fascist movements employ an almost expert use of arts, music, rallies, which really do attend to the physicality of people in a scary way. I also think some of the most politically conservative, even restrictive religions understand physicality in terms of worship through ecstasy. That was my experience. Like, in rural Minnesota with Pentecostalism, which you'd think is the opposite of the character you normally associate with Stoic Scandinavian and Germanic people. And so you'd see these people who couldn't even put their arm around their son and show affection in public on the floor weeping in religious ecstasy. And so I think it was doing something for them, but their whole relationship with their bodies was so flawed that it almost felt like this hedonistic splurge rather than something that was integrating into their lives. Max continues, it's about mastery over yourself. Yes, it's a continuation of dominion over the earth. The brain soul is us, but the body is just the most immediate and often feminized and raced aspect of the earth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. The way you're describing that is very apt. There really is, like, and this is baked into our Christianity. I talk about this in my book, Unkingdom, for those who want to look it up. But we tend to think of ourselves as more like God, and God is separate from the earth. And our relationship with the earth is one of like subjugation. We interpret Genesis as being called to subjugate the earth. And so anyone who doesn't have a relationship with dominion over the earth is seen as not actually being a good steward of it. And that was actually the justification. Like, so Europeans would come here and say, they're not even farming, really. They're not doing anything with the land to make it prosperous. We're actually doing them a favor by following God's decree to make this land productive. And so the conquest narrative was baked in. We felt like it was almost altruistic. And we still use that logic today. Like, I remember listening to a speech where Obama said, we have to be engaged in the Middle East because our security of oil is part of our national interest. And his argument was, they aren't making the oil flow enough. We have to for our sake, so we get to have the right to do it. It's the same damn logic.
Yeah. Yeah. We should do a whole episode on this idea of the right of conquest. You know, people talk a lot about the doctrine of discovery narrative, but they talk less about the right of conquest narrative, which was a similar doctrine that got promulgated at that time. Yeah, which basically said, like, if you can take somebody over, then you win and you get all the stuff. And I hear that all the time from people here, especially in relationship to Native Americans in the upper Midwest. I mean, I've heard people say all the time, hey, look, they lost, get over it. Like, we get all the stuff.
And there's also this other, like, if they soften it, they'll be like, well, they were conquering each other. And then we came around.
Well,
and
right.
We were better at it. Yeah. Yeah, right. And so therefore we get to have it. But like, sure, if we were here, one of them would have conquered the other people and it would have been the same, but worse, because they wouldn't have iPads. Like, that's kind of the whole lot underwriting logic.
All right. We got to keep rolling here. We Catherine got a lot writes, of good comments.
German Nazis were also lethally ableist. Indeed. Yes. In ways directly influenced by American eugenics movements. Yes. I mean, it's very well known that Hitler was looking into the United States for a lot of his inspirations, and it's uncomfortable to recognize that. For some reason, that doesn't get really talked about really all that much, unless you're in
for
a certain
some
sphere.
Reason.
Instead of seeing different bodies and neurodiversity as part of the interconnected abundance of creation, they categorized disabled people as either productive or useless eaters, and tested their systems of death chambers on those whose body they deem unworthy.
Yeah. And this is still going on. I mean, Lisa McKee, who we had on this program a long time ago, who's a disability activist and Methodist pastor, mm-hmm. you know, she talks about this all the time. I mean, if you're in a wheelchair, it's almost impossible to get a job as a minister. Because the congregation cannot handle it. The ableism is so strong. And again, it's directly tied to this muscular Christianity and all these things that we're talking about. Like, if you're up there in a wheelchair, there must be something wrong with you. God doesn't love you. And, you know, this goes all the way back, right? I mean, the whole leper thing, right? I mean, this is our fear of and our challenge with different embodiments is a very deep-seated thing that not only have we not worked on very well, but in many ways we've continued to stoke the other direction of hatred and abuse of different bodies.
Mm. I don't know how to
Stefan.
Read it.
That's Stefan.
Uh-huh. Stefan, thank you, Dan. Yeah. Teddy Roosevelt was a practitioner of muscular Christianity.
Okay. Doesn't surprise me.
It's no coincidence that, you know, he's traipsing around the world wrestling bears or whatever. Like, part of the military, he was militaristic, going on campaigns and adventures. And he is also the person who pushed almost more than anyone else to have a park service. So these things are all interrelated, as Dan was pointing out. And Teddy Roosevelt, like, he is the poster child for that point in American history when we were really into this. I mean, he's, yeah. Ron writes, in 1952, I was 8. My pastor was shockingly good looking. It was like a drug. My judgment was ditched. I fear I would have followed him off a cliff. Cool. And again, it's like attractiveness and physical qualities are judged based on their usefulness. And in our context, mm-hmm. usefulness for success in a way that it's often tied up in ascending a ladder of dominance, even in ministry. Catherine writes, my life changed for the better when I made the connection between grief and my body. I work out as a way to work with the grief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, grief is a very embodied reality.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that. Series writes, Americans appropriating science for bullshit nonsense is sad, not surprising. It's the American way.
Even. Well, it's certainly the corporate way. And I mean, there's no better example of that, right, than the nuclear weapons program. And, that is the ultimate in both domination and destruction. We as a species could really use to evolve a bit more. The fact that it has not really occurred to humanity on a wide scale that destroying the planet is not good for us. Like, that's very interesting. I mean, we should be interrogating that and going, like, why haven't we figured that out? I mean, you know, I've done this whole sermon before on the fact that we're really not any smarter than algae. And, you know, that if you put a little bit of algae in a tiny puddle of water, it'll just reproduce until it uses up all the oxygen and dies. And, you know, that's what we're doing. And, right. And so we took the science of splitting the atom, and pretty much the first thing we said was, great, let's make nuclear weapons out of it and all blow each other up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's horrible.
Well, I mean, society, you know, we act as though this environmental degradation is a modern phenomenon, but it's interesting reading different accounts of like what Rome was doing. Empires do this. Like, mm-hmm. Empire takes like our worst habits as a humanity and twists them towards domination becomes the operating script. And that's not true for every culture. But all the worst tendencies of any culture get, you know, amplified in this sort of greater cause. And so like Rome would fell forests and there were species that were wiped out. And so this acceleration of domination is really tied into certain kinds of ideologies and certain ways of being human. And there are better ways of being human. Like, so this is why it's sad that we're so caught up in this domination script that when someone says we almost wiped out indigenous people, it's like, well, you know, we were better at this than them. Like, well, they were better at other stuff than us, but for some reason, that's not as high up in our hierarchy of value. We have to question what we value as a people. And it's still, we somehow still think that we are better than other societies. And we don't really think it's because of, we don't really connect that it's because of our military prowess. It's our ability to dominate and control.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that was, I remember this particularly when, you know, the UN was having the debates about the first Iraq war, right? And Colin Powell was there lying his pants off. And of course, now there are all these great memes with this quote from Colin Powell going, oh, isn't it terrible that people are lying? And I'm like, really? That's terrible, huh?
That was your whole thing.
You know, that was your whole thing. And people are like, oh, I love Colin Powell. He's so great. It's like, tubes. No, he's a war criminal.
Like, look at the middle.
Anyway,
I remember
anyway, I'm like, I've been derailed. But so, you know, in this debate in the UN, I mean, I remember this one guy from Namibia. Right now, Namibia is this country that has no world power domination. They can barely keep their people fed. It's this desert nation in Africa. And this guy was a genius. I mean, he was really brilliant. You know, that beautiful African English. And, you know, and basically what he was saying was like, you know, none of this makes any sense to me. Like, maybe we shouldn't kill hundreds of thousands of people. Maybe there's a better way of dealing with this. Like, maybe diplomacy and peace is a better way to go. Like, the guy was completely right on, 100%, everything he was saying. But, you know, what was obvious after 10 minutes was like, okay, but you're from Namibia, so nobody's going to fucking listen to you. And yet, he was the smartest guy in the room. And you know, he was ignored, and Namibia doesn't have a giant empire, and now there's, you know, over 100,000 Iraqis dead, and people think Colin Powell is cool. So it's, yeah, this is very powerful stuff and very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. I have a lot of thoughts coming through my mind, but moving on because we're running out of time. Ceres writes, even evolution mostly supported cooperation. I mean, that's a fascinating contrast, is reading Charles Darwin and also reading Peter Kropotkin and other evolutionary biologists who look at the role of cooperation as a driving mechanism of evolution. Being challenged and being aligned with neurology, Americans still found a way to twist it. We focused on this idea of the survival of the fittest and then twist it to underscore the American capitalist ethos. It's bizarre. Yeah.
Well, and even that phrase, right? And it's kind of like the carpe diem thing that you were talking about earlier, right? So fittest you know, we use that phrase and we turn fittest into most pumped up, into most muscular, into most dominant, into the one that can kill everybody and take over. Whereas in evolutionary biology, fittest simply means the one that has the most offspring. And you could actually be the weakest, right? So, you know, bacteria are the most fit of any evolutionary being, which is why they've survived for 4 billion years, because they can make more bacteria like it's going out of style. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have taken that term and applied and imposed this imperial political sociological definition onto it. And yeah, and then it's incredibly easy to miss the cooperative aspects of evolving ecosystems that are required for all these species to come about in the first place.
Well, and it stops being about the adaptations of a species to races within competing against other races, to individuals within societies competing against other individuals. And already it's just so just, you know, removed from the context of which survival of the fittest would have been used, to the to some guy, Jeff Bezos, being the fittest. Like that, Charles Darwin, that wouldn't make any damn sense to Charles Darwin. CK writes, it's like the monarchy and how kings and queens are ordained by God and disabled family members are hidden away.
Yeah.
That's right. That's how it works. Joyce writes, an excellent book, by the way. I just finished it and recommend it. I'm assuming you're talking about Unkingdom.
That's your book. Yes, it is an excellent book.
Yeah, so buy it most places online. Kathleen writes, I hate to see people camping in our state parks with these huge expensive camping vehicles. It is always funny to me. And part of it's I have a snobbery because I'm a rural Minnesotan. I'm like, why? Stay in a hotel if you're gonna do that. They set up giant TV screens next to the campfires.
I have a whole riff on that from Deborah and my experience during the pandemic of camping in these places. And, you know, we're surrounded by these people that have the TVs. People put out rugs. I mean, the equipment is unreal. And when Deborah and I are sitting there at our picnic table with like a candle and a deck of cards, we're like, we have a deck of cards. You know, it's like, well, I got a trailer full of 27 different ATVs and boats and all this. But yeah, it's hilarious. No.
John saying yes to something that we said. Maria writes, thank I've you. Been to a lot of national parks. I think there's a place for sanctuaries. I agree. Like, I think we need more places that are untrammeled. And I think it's not entirely a bad, like I go to state parks. So it's like,
oh yeah, no, it's, but yeah, no, it's not that it's a bad thing. It's just noticing that when these sanctuaries exist within a toxic relationship to the rest of creation, you can't keep that toxicity out. Right. Yeah. I mean, sanctuaries, different spaces, creating holy places. That's awesome. What is our relationship with the rest of the natural world is really important to take a look at.
Mm-hmm. That looks like CK gets the final word. A disability and or affliction is looked at as an economic burden on society in the same way funding for childhood cancer research versus breast cancer research. Yes. I mean, there's so much about like disability, consumer capitalism and what it values for productivity, the colonization, the way we treat our own body. Like there's so much that connects to this pathologically broken relationship we have with the bodies, our bodies and the rest of creation.
Yeah. Well, and look, I mean, people in the Trump administration have been absolutely clear about the fact that they don't care that COVID is killing old people. And one of the things that I know that they are thinking about is that this is going to decrease Medicare spending, right? You know, so if we kill a bunch of old people who are on Medicare and, you know, their nursing home care is getting paid for by Medicare and all this, we're going to decrease government spending by just getting rid of them. And they've been very, very frank about that.
Sarries gets the final word. State parks are done to kick out indigenous people who lived in those state parks. I mean, certainly we could have a whole conversation about the relationship of like the resistance to turning over state and federally owned lands to indigenous peoples.
Yeah.
Is often tied to like this weird twisted logic of like, well, yeah, but what they're going to do with that land, as though somehow our society has earned the right. It's like whenever we say that country can't have a nuclear weapons program because they might do something bad with it. We're the only ones who have.
So. All right. Well, this was awesome. Thank you. And always great to have some new folks joining in. And of course, our wonderful regular commentators. And so enjoy your weekend. Stay safe from the COVID zombies. And we'll be back on Monday.
See you next week, everybody.
All right. Bye.
Thank you.